Every day, thousands of Comcast engineers and technologists like Leslie put people at the heart of everything they create.
With my team at Comcast, we developed the Xfinity Voice Remote and tested it to recognize different types of accents, inflections, and languages.
New movies?
Movies for kids.
Películas para las familias.
Now 40 million voice commands a day are heard by the Xfinity Voice Remote. Visit ComcastCorporation.com to learn more.
DR Power Equipment is the industry leader in field and brush mowers. Their full line of machines are designed to clear acres of tough weeds, woody brush, and saplings up to 3 inches thick, hour after hour, year after year. Just one mow, and you'll agree nothing stops a DR. Visit drpower.com to learn more and shop the sale today.
Go loud.
What you waiting for? Put your back in it. Just a little more. Throw your whip in the snow. Tell your body a tent. Walk it hard and low. When you finish that,
the hip knocker.
Episode 179 of the Talking Bollocks podcast, brought to you by Go Loud. It's me, COB.
It's me, Terry Flower.
And today we're joined by
Ibrahim.
Ibrahim, thank you very much for coming into us.
You're welcome.
We're going to get into some details of probably the biggest news story from the past year or so. Do you want to give us a little bit of a background about yourself and account of what happened on October 7th?
Yeah. So my name is Ibrahim Anaga. I'm an Irish citizen originally from Palestine, from Gaza. On the 7th of October, I was in Gaza. I was there as part of an extended holiday, if you want to call it, planning to stay there for a couple of months. It was maybe up to a year, maybe. Unfortunately, it didn't go as planned. I mean, I was only there in July. So 3 months in, 7th of October came. It was a thing that changed our lives completely. And thank God we are back in Ireland. I came back on the 18th of November. Mm.
Did you travel to Palestine much from Ireland?
Well, you see, because Gaza has always been under siege and always been very difficult to get in and out. So my way of doing it was, I mean, I've been living here now for 15 years. And over the last 15 years, I only went there three times. That was my third time going there. But every time I go there, I make sure to make as much of it as possible. So I'll go there for a number of months. And thankfully, my job, my career is in IT, so I can do a lot of remote working while staying over there.
And before October 7th and the other two times you visited, what was it like over there?
I mean, life inside Gaza, it's a normal life. I mean, it's a city that had difficulties like... you know, there was always shortage of energy resources. There was problems with getting in and out because borders were always closed. There was some level of poverty, we can say that. But in general, it was a nice city, a beautiful city, a city full of life. People of Gaza are people that have been through hard times for many years, but they knew how to be resilient, strong, and just enjoy life with the very simple things, you know. It's a city by the coast, by the Mediterranean Sea, so that gave it a bit of beauty to the city. It's a beautiful city. If you look at photos of Gaza before 7th of October, you'll be amazed how beautiful of a city it was.
Mm. Unfortunately, you told us you were over there on October 7th.
Yeah.
What was that like?
So it was a Saturday. So I'm off work and my children, they don't go to school. They were not enrolled in anything. So we had some plans to go out to the beach. We usually go to a restaurant on Saturday and we were planning to go to the beach. It was lovely, you know, that time of the year, the weather just amazing. So we had a lot of plans really to do. And unfortunately, I remember very well that it was around 6 a.m. in the morning when we started to hear missiles and rockets everywhere and explosions, huge, huge explosions. From time to time, you experience some of that in Gaza, but it's always, you know, some small things happen here and there. But 10, 15, 20 minutes into it, the level of bombings was unbelievable, non-stopping. I knew something big was going on. Turned on the TV and it turned out something big was happening. Usually when that happens, I've witnessed one war before I came to Ireland. It was 2008. I know what needs to be done in a situation like this. So first thing that you'll think of is try to get, for example, as much supplies as you, food supplies as much as you can, water supplies as well, if anyone needs any medicine or anything like this, but also get all your documents, your valuables, all in one place, just beside you, in case anything happens, you have to run away. You know, things like trying to figure out where could the safest place in the house be. So just beside, for example, you know, those big walls that hold the whole building, you know, pillars or whatever.
Yeah.
You just try to think, okay, where is the safest place? That might be it. If the bombing gets really more and more intense, maybe it's better if you just go downstairs to the basement or, you know, things like that. Try to also calm down the children, because my children, it was the first time for them to experience something like this. They were really scared. We tried to calm them down, you know. So that was the first, let's say, couple of hours on the 7th of October for us.
So you said you knew what to do in that situation. So I suppose it would be uncommon for people in Gaza and all of Palestine to be accustomed to stuff like this and know how to react in these kind of emergencies.
Yeah. I mean, I was even getting calls from, I remember getting called from my cousin telling me, you know what to do. Just get as much bread. I told him, I remember all of that. I know what to do, you know. So, we got prepared. And I remember that day at night, we as a family, we felt it might not be a good idea if we stayed on our own. You know, my in-laws, they were living around 300-400 meters away from where I was living. So I thought maybe it's a better idea just for all of us to stay, just find company, you know, and not just staying on our own. Especially that this is something that we got used to during wars, is electricity would cut off because from bombings, you know, wires or cables could be cut off, or the main where the electricity generation, of course, you know, it gets targeted. And specifically on that day, I mean, most of our energy resources actually come from Israel, are imported from Israel. We have a small generator, but most of it comes from Israel. And from day one, it was announced that Israel is going to cut off electricity, water, food, borders, all of that. So we felt it straight away. Electricity was cut off. Internet was cut off. We still had phone connections, so that was the only thing that we had. Charging our phones was very difficult, because what you needed is any one of the neighbors that has a solar system, you will go there and you charge your phone. Okay, so that's what we were doing. But we thought it might be a good idea if we stay with our in-laws and not rather stay alone. And my brothers-in-law and sisters-in-law, they all did the same thing. So we all gathered in my in-law parents' house for that night. And again, bombing was horrible. I mean, especially that we were staying in an area that is, it's kind of central in Gaza, where we had a lot of governmental offices around us. We had the university that I was studying at. It was only 2 kilometers away. And these were kind of things that typically get targeted initially. Okay, so first day, the heaviest bombings were just around us. Okay, and because my in-laws, I think they're on the third floor in the building, so the higher it's up, you feel the shaking whenever the bombs comes. You know, some of the bombs that came down, I was feeling. You see, what happens is you will hear this whistling noise coming down, right? And then the second thing you will notice is a big shake. The house just shakes. And then a split of a second, you hear this big, huge banging noise. And you will hear sometimes windows somewhere being broken or something like this, you know. So that's how it was the first day. That was the atmosphere the first day, you know.
How are you getting your updates? So you said the power is gone, the internet is gone. Are you aware of what's going on? Are you just thinking this is so severe?
Yeah, as part of our preparations also for war is you will have a radio and you'll have batteries. So that's your source of information. So we were all sitting around, all of us in darkness, I remember at night, we were all just sitting around, just listening to the radio, you know, and at the same time hearing the noises, the banging and the missiles coming down.
How many of you was in there?
So the first couple of days, we were in my in-law's house. We were the father, the mother, my parents-in-law. They have 3 children. My wife, her sister has a family. So we were 8 adults and we were 5 children.
So 13, yeah.
Yeah.
And what's, so this is all going on, yous are all getting together now, yous are all under the one roof. What's his thought process? What's the plan from there?
You see, there's, the problem is there's no plans. You just sit down, hope that everything is okay, especially during the night, it intensifies. What we were thinking of is, especially that the bombing was getting closer and closing, and you know, my children just couldn't you know, handle it, and screaming and crying and all of that. So third day in, I was thinking it might be a better idea if we move away from Gaza City and go to my parents' house. Now, my parents have a kind of a farmhouse in the south in a city called Khan Yunis. And usually places like this, far away farm areas, far away from the city, are usually exposed to less amount of bombings. So we thought it might be a good idea to go there. But the problem is that the level of bombings was huge, and we were hearing some horrible stories that people were in a car just moving and they were targeted. There was even ambulances that were targeted. So having that move was very, very risky, but I thought we might do it now rather than later when things might get even worse. So I'm talking about 3 or 4 days in Gaza in my parents' house. We took the decision, all of us. We decided, okay, we should go. And now we were preparing, what is the plan to go from Gaza to Khan Yunis? It's around a 25 minutes drive, okay? Now, my father-in-law, he has a small car, so it didn't fit all of us. We had to find a taxi. We had to pay him a lot to take that journey. It was one of the scariest moments for us throughout the whole 50 days that I was there. Just that 25 minutes drive. You know, we were thinking this could be it, you know, for us, especially bombings all around us. And you're just driving in a car and you see, you can even see, you know, missiles coming down or in the distance and all of that. But the plan was that because we know how things work, and there's usually these spying drones that fly over the sky. And this is like the eye to the Israeli army. So by them, they know what's going on and what's moving and all of that. And when I was there, I was trying, over the 4 days, I was trying to think of the pattern, how they work. So the way they work is that one drone comes in, it flies for about an hour maybe, and you will hear that it goes for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, and then it comes back. I don't know if it's get refueled or the new one comes in. I don't know what's going on. But what I was trying to think is that maybe that's the best thing to do, is wait for that drone to go away. And I know it's going to be 5 minutes before a new one comes in, or 10 minutes. But those are the critical minutes that we need to get out, at least from that danger area, you know. So we prepared everything in the car. And we found the taxi and we told them, look, we just wait for the drones to go away and then we start moving as fast as possible, you know. So that was the plan. We got everything ready. That moment came, the drones went, and we were just flying. And it was really, we were trying to think, what is the best route? So there's two main roads, linking Gaza and Khan Yunis. We started to go to the one that's the closest, and the shortest and the fastest. But we were surprised that there was a building that was just targeted and it closed that road. So we quickly had to make a U-turn, take the other route. And yeah, I mean, oh my God, these were really
crucial minutes.
And everyone was extremely nervous. We couldn't talk. We couldn't do anything. It's saying all the prayers that you know and feeling that this could be it really. But thank God, minute by minute, we were getting away from Gaza and we were starting to feel the relief. 10 minutes, let's say 10, 15 minutes, things got a lot calmer. We were out of the danger zone, let's say, and we reached my father's house. Now, my father was not there. He was actually traveling outside of Gaza at that time. So the house was kind of empty. So we were the first group to come in. The whole family that was in Gaza, we were the first to come in into that house. Things were okay after that for a couple of days. All the bombings was actually happening in Gaza. Khan Yunis was kind of calm. But it was only a matter of 3-4 days in Khan Yunis when the Israeli army announced that the whole of Gaza City is a military operation zone, and it was asking for all of the people to evacuate from the north to the south. And at that point, I started to getting a lot of phone calls from friends, relatives, neighbors, people that I know from Gaza, asking if they can come to my house in Khan Yunis, because they all had to leave. So I just said, look, I just thought to myself, I'll just welcome as much people as I can, because at that time, everyone was thinking, it's only going to be like, what, a couple of days, and we will go back to Gaza. So I said, no bother. I mean, I can just, it's going to be a couple of days. We can survive, you know. So a lot of calls, people asking, can I come in? Yeah, sure, come in. And it was only 2 days, we were around 90 people in the house. 90. Yeah.
So what does that, like 90 people there, what does that do then for like food and water supplies?
This is the problem. You see, when they all came in, I was telling them, look, you're all welcome, but please bring as much as you can in terms of food, water, fuel in your car, blankets, pillows, mattresses, everything. So everyone that came in brought in something with them. So, I mean, whatever we had, it was okay maybe for 4 days, 5 days. So we were thinking, and I thought, well, it's going to be for a couple of days anyway. But first day, second day, we were running into our supplies, and I thought, okay, we need to do something. We went out to the supermarket, try to buy as much as we can. So we gathered money from all of us, put them in a pot. We took them and whatever you can think of, you can buy in a supermarket, we bought. And supplies in supermarkets were, we really felt that because everyone is like in panicking and trying to get as much as they can, the supplies in supermarkets were going down very fast. So another couple of days, so let's say a week after everyone is in here, we started to feel what you call dangerous levels of low supplies. So every day in the morning, as a group, we organized ourselves to divide ourselves into groups. So some group will go try to get, for example, bread from a bakery. So group will go there. Some people will go to supermarket in this area. Some people go to supermarket in this area. So it's like going out, trying to find any supermarket that has any supplies and just whatever it is, just bring it in, you know. And by the day, it was getting a lot harder. And then we were at the point where we were not able to source enough food for the whole day. So we had to all have to cut down on how much food we were eating and how much water we were eating. Let's say 2 weeks when everyone was in here, it was starting to get into really dangerous levels. So we were only having one meal a day. Children might be asking for something in the evening, for example. We would give them a little bit extra, you know, so because they don't really understand what's going on. But for us adults, it was just one meal a day, cutting down on water as much as possible. Now, luckily that in the house we had this water well, which is used to just for watering the plants and the farm. But the water needs filtration for human consumption.
Yeah.
So it was only used for the farm anyway. But because we were in the group, we were a couple of engineers, so we know how things were working. So we were able to do some wiring and connections to, my father had a solar system in the house, so we were able to use the solar system to power on the well and the pump to get water out. And we got big containers. We just put them all together. We did all the connections. So we will fill the water containers, let's say every 2 or 3 days, you know, turn it on, get water out, fill them and try to use as little as possible. The water was in normal situation. There's no way you can drink it, but we were forced to drink it. So that was how life was. And again, and the problem was that the bombing in Khan Yunis started to increase and intensify. And let's say a week or 2 weeks in, we were feeling them really, really close. And especially during the night was scariest. lot of days or a lot of nights we were thinking we will not going to make it to the next day.
So this was after the fact that Israel have gave the command that Gaza is the operation.
Exactly.
And everybody should move south.
South. Yes. So Khan Yunis, even though it was supposed to be the safe area, it was far away from that. Bombing was everywhere. Yeah. And I mean, there was even some cases where we had a house that got bombed that was only like 500 meters away. And the type of bombs that they were using this time, it was unbelievable, because it not only does it destroy, for any reason, they just target one house. They don't just destroy one house. The bomb that they use, it will destroy like 5 or 6 houses and all that. So this is the problem, is that you don't know if the house next to you is going to be targeted. And if it is, you're going to be gone, you know?
Yeah, there's so much collateral damage.
Yeah.
So you said that you have a radio to keep updates of what's happening. So you are aware of the operation that's underway. You were aware it was Hamas attacking Israel at the time.
Yep.
What are the civilians like ourselves? What is your attitude then? Like, we just move away from all this and hopefully that could sort itself out?
Yeah. So, I mean, normal people are, which the majority of the people of Gaza are just normal people. They're not involved with Hamas, or they're just normal people minding their own businesses, doing their daily lives, you know. So people are just hoping that things will, things got a bit messy initially. People were just hoping it's going to be, hopefully it's going to be sorted out, you know, some agreement or truce agreement will happen and we just can continue our lives as normal. But now that's, 8 or 9 months now, and nothing has been happening.
For almost 40 years, DR Power Equipment has been the go-to for homeowners who want professional-level outdoor power equipment. Whether you're managing acres of overgrown fields or just want to have the best lawn on the block, DR Power has everything you need to conquer your piece of the outdoors. Visit drpower.com today to learn more and shop the sale.
So you mentioned at the start you're an Irish citizen. So do you want to take us back to maybe where you were born and what was life like growing up for you?
Okay. So I was born in Saudi Arabia. My father, he was a doctor and he worked in Saudi Arabia for a couple of years. And he decided to come to Ireland to do his training and, you know, just some of his higher education. So we as a family came to Ireland in 1989, and I was 4 years old at that time. We stayed here until 1994. So 5 years I was living here when I was a small boy. And during that time, I had 2 brothers and 1 sister were born here in Ireland. And at that time, anyone born in Ireland is automatically an Irish citizen. So when we left to Gaza in 1994, it was only my younger 2 brothers and my sister who were Irish citizens at that time. I was not. Moved back to Palestine. I was 9 years old or 8 years old at that time. And life was normal. It was calm years. It was peaceful years in the late 90s. So we had a good life. Let's say my father had a good position back home. We were living comfortably over there. The only thing that I remember is that Gaza has always been under siege. So from 1995 until I came to Ireland in 2009, I never left Gaza. All the time I was in Gaza. And 99% of the people that I live with or people I know in Gaza, they never left Gaza. So it was like, for us, we're living in a nice place. Bit of difficulties, but we don't know anything about the outside world. And especially at that time, there was no like social medias or smartphones. Everything that we know about is just Gaza. So life was normal. Went to school, finished my leaving cert, got good grades, and went and did my bachelor's degree, university degree in electronic engineering in Gaza. And I finished in 2008 my university. And at that time, I had a dream to go and continue my studies. For some reason, I had this dream to do my master's and PhD in the UK. And if you ask me why, it's because everyone that taught me in university had their degree from the UK. I was thinking that's the place to go to. So that was my dream. And I finished university. I tried, contacted some universities in the UK, and I got an acceptance place, but I was faced with the big problem, which was getting out of Gaza. Getting out of Gaza was extremely limited, very difficult. Borders were closed for a couple of many months sometimes. So my course in the UK had started and I was still stuck in Gaza. So my dreams were starting to fall apart. Until December 2008, where a war started in Gaza, a much smaller scale than the one we see today. But there was a war over there and it lasted for around 20 or 30 days. But during that war, what happened was that we got a phone call from the Irish embassy telling us that we know that there are Irish citizens. Remember when I told you I had two brothers and one sister, they were born here. So we were told that we can offer help to them if you would like to get them out to safety, to evacuate them to Ireland. And I thought to myself, this might be a good idea if I could ask to, as they were underage, if I can come with them. And I was thinking to myself, this could be an opportunity for me to get out of Gaza and just go and continue my studies. Okay. So we were out of Gaza. I was out with my underage brothers and sister. We were all out. My father was a doctor. He thought it was a better idea if he stayed and you know, helped with the hospitals and all of that. And I got the opportunity. We came out to safety here in Ireland. The war finished. My brothers and sister, they decided to go back to continue their education. They went back. I stayed here. I tried to get a visa to go to the UK. I was faced with a lot of problems. It ended up I couldn't go to the UK, so decided to go to DCU here in Ireland. So I did my master's here in Ireland. I finished the master degree. And since then, I have been working full time as an electronic engineer across many companies here. So that's really how it all started. And that was, I came 2009, so it's 15 years here now in Ireland.
And that's why you kept going back and forth?
Yeah. So over, as I said, over the last 15 years, I was only able to make it three times to... Now, I was an Irish citizen in 2013. So when you're a foreign national, it's a bit easier to get in and out, not like the normal people, but it's still very difficult. Anyway, I mean, every time I go there, it would take me months to get out. So my first visit was, it was, I think, 2014, first time I went to Gaza from 2009. And there was another visit. And then the third one where it was last year.
And why is it so difficult?
You see, the border, it closes for long time. It's unpredictable. You can be there and you just go find out that the border is closed. There's no way to exit out. And when it opens, you will be faced by a huge queue of people that are trying. And the amount of people are extremely limited that can get out. So they will say, okay, there's only, let's say, 100 or 200 allowed to leave per day. But what we find out is that there's thousands on the queue trying to get out. So by the time you're, and the border could close at any time, so people just get delayed more and more and more. So that's why the problem really is there.
And do you have to exit through Israel?
No, we only have a single border with Egypt. Unfortunately, I don't know the politics of it, but the Egyptian just put like heavy, you know, rules and unfair rules, let's say, on people trying to get in and out of Gaza. And that's where, you know, it gets really difficult.
How many kids have you got?
Three.
Three kids?
Yeah.
All, how old are they?
So I have Sammy, who is 8 and a half now. I have Eileen, she is 4. Omar, 3.
All born in Ireland?
All born in Ireland, yes.
How do you think it's affected the kids from October 7th, that trip over there?
Now, if you meet my children... thankfully, you'll feel that they're normal kids now. Mm. Mm. They got over it. They remember, especially Sammy, the eldest, he will remember what was going on. He will know what's going on. The younger two, I think they were a bit young. They might not remember. They will know that, for example, the word of a missile, the Arabic word of a missile, which is saruq. And if you tell them what is a saruq, they will say it's an like explosion noise. You know, they will remember all of that. But thankfully, they're okay now. And I made sure once we came back that children, my children, and they all go back to their normal life as quickly as possible. So we arrived here on a Saturday. Sammy was back in school on Monday. Eileen was in preschool on Tuesday, and I was back to work on Wednesday. So we tried to, you know, as quickly as possible, go back to our normal lives, try to get over it and back to normal, really.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, but I'm sure it was such a traumatic experience for you, the kids and everybody over there at that time. How did you eventually get out after 50 days over there?
Okay, so remember when I told you in 2009, the war broke out and we got help from the embassy. Usually what happens during a war is that all the foreign embassies, whoever had a citizen in inside Gaza, the embassy would try to contact them and make some plans to evacuate them out. And this usually happens first 1, 2, 3, maybe 1 week during the war. All foreign nationals will be evacuated. Okay. And this is from day one, I contacted the Irish embassy asking for help to evacuate me. And I was thinking it's going to be a couple of days and I'm out. But this time things were a lot different. It took around 1 month till first people were allowed to leave Gaza. Okay. And the way it worked that every day there will be list of nationalities that will be allowed to leave Gaza. So, for example, usually what was happening was after 1 month, there was announcement that citizens, for example, of USA, UK, you know, the big countries are allowed to leave. So I was thinking, okay, Ireland is not a big country. Maybe it will take us a couple of days and they will announce people from Ireland are allowed to leave. No, we're not too much, you know. As far as I know, we were only 7 or 8 families, I think, who have Irish nationality, who were there in Gaza during the war. So we were all well connected during the war and all talking, oh, hopefully it's going to be next day, you know. Unfortunately, Ireland didn't come up on the list. It all started with Western countries and then slowly it moved away. So Ireland was missed. So you will see like countries like, for example, Italy, Hungary, Greece, all of these countries. And then we were starting to see countries like, for example, Jordan, India, other countries. We felt that Ireland was just left behind, you know. And Ireland was one of the very last countries that came up on the list. I'm not sure the reason, if there was any politics behind all of that. I don't know what was the reason. But it took us, since the beginning of the war, around 50 days till Ireland was given the green light to people from with Irish nationality to leave. So it was the night before we got the call from someone from Department of Foreign Affairs telling us, I know in advance that Ireland's going to be appearing on the list for tomorrow. So be prepared. You're going to be leaving tomorrow. And it was, you know, a big relief. So it was me, my wife, my 3 children. And I was also able, with the help of the Irish Embassy and Department of Foreign Affairs, also to get my father-in-law and my mother-in-law with us out as well.
Are you all still in the farmhouse at this stage?
When we got the call, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what's that situation like then with everybody? There was 90 people there, wasn't
it?
Yeah. Do you go and explain this to them? Do you going to be leaving?
Well, the people in my house, they knew that we had Irish nationality. So they were expecting that at some stage that we would be leaving. But I ensured everyone, look, even if I left, I'm not going to kick you out. You know, you're, you know, situation where we all have to be thinking as a group or not just selfish. So you're all welcome to stay even after I leave. There's no problem, you know. So we got the news a bit in advance. It was kind of late at night. We didn't want to tell anyone. So we waited till the morning. Everyone wake up and we told them the news that Ireland is going to be on the list today and we're leaving now. So we're preparing ourselves. So we said goodbye to everyone. And I have a lot of photos and videos from that day. And but again, it was a very risky journey because my house is around 10, 15 minutes drive away from the border. And at that time, fuel was drying up in all of Gaza. So you would notice that cars were not moving around at all. And the only thing that was moving around was either bicycles, people walking, or, you know, these horses that pull these, what do you call them?
Carts.
Carts, yeah. And that was the only thing that was moving. But I had my father's car was there, and I always knew that I wanted to leave a bit of fuel for that journey, you know. But I was just hoping that because we didn't turn on the car for a month now. So I was just all the night thinking, is the car going to work or not? And if it doesn't work, what are the B plans, you know? But thankfully, the car did turn on. We were able to go to the border, but it was a very risky journey because bombings was everywhere. Everything that's moving is a high risk
target.
Yeah. So,
do you head to the Egyptian border? So are you evacuated then? Come to the border and you explain the situation.
Yeah. So the people at the border will expect, they know that, for example, today we're expecting to see nationalities of these and countries. I remember it was Norway, Spain, Ireland, I can't remember who, Russia as well. So these were all countries. We were all on the same day evacuated together.
What's the situation like now with everybody in overtime since you've left?
So everyone stayed in the house with a very difficult situation. They stayed in the house after us for around, I can't remember, it was 10 or 20 days. And then Khan Yunis, now, so to see the zone that I told you that in north of Gaza kept on expanding. And 20 days after I left, that zone now included all of Khan Yunis. So all of that area was in the zone. So everyone in the house had to leave. They all moved to Rafah, which I think everyone hears about now in the news. So it was 20 days. Everyone just moved, got squeezed in that small area, and that house was empty. And unfortunately, that house is destroyed now with all houses around us, our neighbors, everyone's house is destroyed in that area.
And are you still in contact with those people?
Yeah, although maintaining contact is very difficult because of, you know, internet is very limited. Phone calls are limited. There's sometimes, I experience some days over there where they will call it a blackout, where whole of Gaza is just disconnected. Phones are disconnected, internet is disconnected, landline is everything is disconnected from the whole world. No one is able to contact you. So up to this day, there are some periods that come where no one is able to contact anyone inside of Gaza. And even if that doesn't happen, as I said, either their phone are not charged or they don't have internet or weak coverage. So having contact is very difficult.
You mentioned that some of your in-laws come back to Ireland with
you.
What's their status now over here?
So this is a problem that we are having, which is, remember when I told you my parents were here visiting my brother? I have another brother now. He was one of the brothers that was born here. So they were visiting him before the 7th of October. They were planning to return back to Gaza on the 17th of October. So since then, they are stuck. They're here in Ireland. That's my parents. And then when I came in November, I came with my parents-in-law. So it's my parents and my parents-in-law. They were given like a visa to enter Ireland. And usually you get like a permission to stay for 3 months when you're coming visiting Ireland. But once those 3 months expired, we were not able to get something long-term. We're not able to get any residency. So unfortunately, we're in a situation where their visa has expired. We are not given any extension or any long-term residency. And unfortunately, they can't, for example, access any healthcare or, you know, they're not allowed to leave Ireland, because if they leave Ireland, the problem is they won't be able to come back again. So, and they're illegal. I mean, living in this situation is very stressful for us and for them. I mean, I've been trying with a couple of TDs to try and help sort them out, try to get them, you know, what I'm asking for is really if they could be treated like, you know, Ukrainian refugees or before that when Syrians came in, especially that there are around 17 in total people that Irish government got from Gaza to here. and they were all given permission to enter, but they're not given permission to stay. And I really wish that this issue could be resolved where they could get some kind of residency and settle in here, especially that no one is can go back to Gaza, you know.
But what would the plan be for them? I don't understand.
Problem is, no, there's no plan B. I mean,
they obviously expected this to be resolved a lot quicker than.
But now that it's not resolved, what?
Yeah.
What?
We're just hoping. We're just trying our best. TDs, you know, politicians, whoever can help with this situation.
But I can't wrap my head around how they can give like a 3-month visa, let's say, to get out of there. Obviously, they were hoping it would be resolved maybe in 3 months or whatever. But now that's not resolved, it's just like, okay, you're stuck. There's nothing for
you. As you said, there's only 7 days in as well. Can we not make exemptions?
Exactly. That's all what we're arguing is that we're only 17 in total. Those are people who were in Gaza and were brought in here, in addition to my two parents that were visiting here. But those are people that the Irish government have brought them in there. They're really from Gaza. And we're talking about only 17 in Gaza. Everyone knows what's going on in Gaza. And there's no way no one can return back to Gaza. But at the same time, there's thousands of people from Ukraine that have been welcomed here in Ireland. How come we're not able to help only those 17 people, really?
Mm. I know you're not a historian and a political expert, but can you give us a brief kind of history of what the conflict in Israel and Gaza is all about? Because I'm 30, and as far as I can remember, it's always been on the news that there's conflict in Gaza or the West Bank or Israel and Palestine. It's just always been a thing. And I'm not sure anyone can really understand.
Yeah, yeah.
I know it's complicated. I'm not expecting you to know the intricate details of it all, but can you give us a brief one?
So it all goes back to, I'm not a historian, but I'll tell you what I understand from the history, which is Palestine was part of the Ottoman Empire. That's before World War One, where the Ottoman Empire was just dissolved and it was broken up into these small countries. So Palestine, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, they were all part of that big nation, let's call it. Once the Ottoman Empire broke up, England came and had settlements in Palestine and in Jordan, while France took over Syria and Lebanon. That was how it was divided at that time. And there's this famous Sykes-Picot agreement between France and UK to divide all of that land between them. And we were under the British Empire. And during that time, England had started moving refugees, Jewish refugees from all around the world to Palestine. And it intensified during the Second World War, where we all know what happened to Jewish people in Europe. And so England, you know, brought in many, many people. And first of all, they were put in like settlements, Israeli settlements, or Jewish, let's call it that time. It was all Palestine until 1948. It was Palestine. And Jewish just got armed and they got the weapons. But at the same time, the people of Palestine, they were denied to given anything. So what we were seeing is that the Jewish settlements got bigger, 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 and they were just doing a lot of massacres to kick out people from their homes and try to get as much land as possible. What we see now, Palestinian refugee camps in Lebanon, in Syria, and in Jordan. So these are all people that were forced to move out of their land and go to these neighboring countries. And that all kept on happening until 1948, where Israel established their country. And they, at that time, they controlled most of the historical Palestine. What was left is people living in Gaza and people living in the West Bank. So these are all where they moved everyone from the center towards the edges. So now that's where you see Gaza at the one corner, and then you see the West Bank at the other corner. So these were Palestinians were pushed out to these areas, and all that land in the big middle, that was all now Israel. Okay. Now, as normal people do when their land is taken, is that they try to resist back. And, you know, especially that we were living under really bad conditions. Israel was controlling everything on us until 1994, where we had like this Palestinian Authority, but it wasn't really an actual country because we still had a lot of settlements and we still had all of our borders controlled by Israel. We were not allowed to have an airport. We're not allowed to have our, even our mobile connections. It was all controlled by Israel. If you had to, if you wanted to dial Palestine, you had to put the Israeli code to call in Palestine, you know. So the normal thing when people are under oppression and under, you know, especially that there was a lot of people that have been killed in conflicts and a lot of prisoners and a lot of political prisoners. And I guess people here in Ireland, they understand this, especially with the problems that they had in the north. So this is the life that we were living in. Now, unfortunately, people of Gaza, because we were under huge siege and living conditions was a bit difficult. You know, there's a lot of conflicts that kept on happening. It was a bit calmer in the West Bank, but Gaza, it had always been in conflict. Things got just building up until it got really bad in 2023, that what we were seeing over the last year.
Are you taught this growing up? Like, as far back as I can remember, in primary school, you're taught all about the British oppression and how that 800 years of conflict and then what went on up the north and the sectarianism and the six counties and stuff like that, and you reference that other people will be able to draw similarities. Are you taught this growing up?
We're not only taught that, but we were living it, because everyone was knowing someone that had a relative that was killed or someone that is already in prison by Israel because of his political ideas or whatever, or for, you will see in the news like a small kid just throwing stones and he'll be in prison, you know. So we were actually living it. And the people of Gaza, you see, remember when I told you people were pushed away? So people of Gaza, it's the highest densely populated area in the whole world.
Yeah.
It's a small area where it is a home for 2.5 million people. Half of those are originally from Gaza, but the other half, and even a bit more than half, these are people that have fled from surrounding areas around Gaza that's now been part of Israel. So they will know that I am, for example, from this town or from this city that's under occupation of Israel. So what I'm trying to say is that occupation is something that we were living through, not just educated.
You obviously spoke about oppression and retaliation then from oppression, and but nobody can condemn what Hamas did in October. That was horrific by every stretch.
Yeah.
Obviously, it doesn't justify anything of what's happening now to the scale of what it is.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to put that out there, that what Hamas did was horrific.
Yeah, sure. But we should understand that, as you said, it's horrific. It's not something that I would like to see happening to anyone. But when, I mean, Gaza has been in a war for many, many, many years. And a lot of people have been killed for over and over and over and over the years. And the point I'm trying to say is that imagine now a child in Gaza right now, okay, where his father is being killed, his relatives killed, his house destroyed, his school is destroyed. He's living in extreme poverty because of the Israeli occupation, right? And he sees the world that no one cares about him. What do you think is going to happen to him? The only thing that he's going to think of is revenge. Now, again, I'm not saying that that's the right thing. Mm-hmm. Killing any person is something horrific. But I think the resolution, I think that, honestly, is that if the people of Gaza were living in normal conditions before 7th of October 2023, we would not have seen the horrific scenes that we have seen. And again, I'm not trying to justify, I'm
no,
trying
100%.
To say that it was the right thing to do, but if you bring some people and put them under pressure, they could explode. Again, try to iterate it for many times.
Yeah.
It's not the right thing.
Yeah.
But I think if people are living under normal situation, we would not have seen what has happened.
What you're saying makes perfect sense, though. You're clearly and obviously not justifying what Hamas did, because it was horrific. But when you look at the circumstances that a lot of these people grew up in with their families, like you said, schools and things.
And the problem is, what's going to happen next? Because now we're seeing a lot of innocent people that were just minding their own business. Suddenly, people have killed their relatives, their parents, their brothers, whoever, the house destroyed. What is going to happen to them? Their schools, their universities, all destroyed. What is going to happen? That's what I fear, really.
They're left with nothing to live for, is what I say.
Yeah.
So this thing is a recipe for disaster.
Exactly.
But there's hundreds of cases of this throughout human history. Like in some people's eyes, certain terrorist organizations are freedom fighters. Yeah. In other people's eyes.
Yeah.
And it's all throughout history. This is no exemption. What do you feel? So you mentioned the Irish attitude towards Ukrainian refugees. And we see in the world, the second Ukraine got invaded by Russia, the whole world has shunned Russia.
Exactly.
And we've seen their athletes even banned from football and the Olympics and stuff like that. What, in your opinion, is the attitude of the international audience towards all of this?
Now, if I divide it into two things, where if we just talk about normal people in the street, people have great empathy towards the Palestinians. And as you just said, they feel what the scale of what Israel is doing is unimaginable. It's horrible, you know. But then we have politicians. Politicians are what I feel is happening, especially the last couple of months, where it got obvious and clear that Israel isn't just fighting Hamas. It's just killing as much as possible and putting the whole people under unlivable conditions and all of that. Is that politicians, sometimes they say that, oh, we want to have peace, or we want to have things, or we want the aids to come in, but their actions are something different, totally different, you know. US will say, we're trying to put peace, we're trying to end our military support to Israel, but the support doesn't stop.
Do you feel a lot more can be done? Because we've seen, and it's rare that this actually happens, but the Irish government have took action to coincide with what the citizens of Ireland actually wanted, and they've recognised Palestine as a state despite the backlash that they got then from Israel.
Yeah.
That probably makes you proud being an Irish citizen beforehand.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you feel a lot more can be done then? A simple motive just like recognising Palestine?
When the news came that Ireland, Spain and Norway was recognising Palestine, I was hoping that that was going to be a step, an initial step where other countries can follow in. And I'm hearing some news that, for example, Malta and Slovenia are thinking of doing the same thing. But I was hoping is that this movement can just keep on growing and growing, and you know, bigger countries will suddenly, or people of bigger countries will put pressure on their governments to recognize Palestine, and that will lead maybe to putting more pressure, you know, and have the whole world to know, for example, that there are illegal settlements. You know, there's a lot of horrible things that people didn't realize or know about, but now when they start to hear, oh, there's a state, there's a new state, there's Palestinian people that should have, you know, their rule over their land, and, you know, they have a right to live in their country, where, you know, just hoping that this is something that would have, it's not as much as I expected, but hopefully one day we will be recognized by every country in the world.
Mm. What is the path to peace? Like, what is the resolution for all of this?
I think the peace is, it's quite clear and it's quite simple. We either have, there was always discussion, I'd say most of the audience listening to us won't know, but we in Palestine, we know there's one of two solutions, which is a one-state solution or a two-state solution. And a one-state solution is a single state where the historical Palestine is just a single country where it consists of Palestinians, Israelis, Jewish, Arab, Muslims, Christians, all living under one state where everyone has exact equal rights, you know, freedom of religion, freedom of movement, having exactly the same rights, right? Or the second solution is a two-state solution where, okay, we will have our real independent sovereign state where we can make our own decisions in a country called Palestine that consists of everyone living in the West Bank and in Gaza. But what we really want to see is, you know, full sovereignty of our country and over our land.
And in a single state solution, would everyone be happy to have that under the one banner of Israel? Or
Well, if we look at the population now, it's a 50-50 divide between Jewish and Arabs. So, I mean, like every country, like every democratic country, we would like to see, you know, parties that's far away from religion and your ethnicity, and just come over all of that and just think as, you know, any resolution or any coalition that, or any party that will serve the whole people, whoever you are.
Yeah. As I said, it is a complicated matter and it is very complex because it goes back as far as the Bible, the nation of Israel and the true people of Israel and who is and who isn't, and by birthright, who's entitled to the land. So it is very complicated. You have a documentary, RTE, have just That's done. Right. Do you want to tell us a bit about that?
So it's basically a documentary about, so we have, as Muslims, we have two festivals, let's call Islamic festivals. They're called Eids.
Yeah.
And there was an Eid that was only a couple of days ago. So RTE produces, like every while, it produces a documentary about a religion and what they do and, you know, their festivals and all of that. And they were preparing this program for Eid al-Adha. And I was contacted and asked if I was to be starring a documentary or a 20-minute program in RTE, just showing my story, but also how it affected our celebration in Eid and what do we do normally and all of that. So that's really the program. And it's, I think people will be able to see it on RTE Player. And it is called Eid al-Adha, Journey of Hope. That's the name of the show.
Brilliant. Ibrahim, I wanted to ask you earlier on, we were talking about the contact that you have with the people that you were living with, the 90 people and stuff who got pushed down to Rafah. Obviously, the contact is limited. But with the contact that you have had, what have they been saying is going on?
Yeah. Conditions for them is horrific. They all really, they reached the point where they don't really care if they live or die because of what's happening to them, you know. Even some people, they just wish they die and their life ends and just not live throughout the, you know, the pain and the suffering that they've been seeing. Or, you know, a lot of people have sent me photos, for example, and the amount of change on a person over a couple of months is a change that you expect to see in years, you know. They all got old and, you know, their faces and their hair and their body, you know, they completely transformed. Nearly everyone who was over there, the way they appear has changed. Yeah, everyone is just saying how difficult life conditions are. You know, it's just horrific.
Yeah, it's, we can't even begin to kind of understand. And that's why we're so happy that you come in to get a first-hand account. Because as we said, it's on the news, it's all over social media, but you're not getting a first-hand account from somebody.
Yeah.
What is your hope for Palestine going forward?
First of all, an immediate ceasefire where people can at least breathe, wake up without any fear. You know, letting the children, you know, just go back to schools at some point, just living normal life. And what I really wish is that Gaza, this beautiful city, could be at some point rebuilt. People of Gaza being given at least some hope, having their houses restored and, you know, just for them to be living a normal life like anyone like us here in Ireland, like any normal people in the world.
I think
there's one more. I just hope if we can speak about a small thing. Now, thankfully, my parents, although they're in a difficult situation, but at least they are in safety here in Ireland. Now, I have my father-in-law. He has a son who only turned 18 before the war. And unfortunately, I was hoping that when we were getting evacuation for my father and my mother-in-law, that we could include him because he's, although he's technically an adult, but he's like, he's still a boy, you know, and he was, he only started college back in Palestine where his university got destroyed. And I really hope that an effort could be done to try and bring him here to Ireland to continue his studies. And, you know, I really feel sorry, especially for him, because he's lost. He studied 1 year. He lost the second year. So 2023, 2024, he lost that year. And I wish we can enroll him or get him back to do his education and continue his studies and not, you know, wasting any more years of his life without doing anything, you know. So I really wish that this is whoever hears us, whoever can help in getting him enrolled in a university here to continue. He's doing accounting. So if anyone could help, I'd really appreciate that.
You'd be surprised. There is a lot of politicians that actually do tune in, and we've had Micheál Martin on, who is the Minister for Foreign Affairs. So let's just hope that we can get him over here. And as you said, it's a continuous study, so it is productive. Yep. And hopefully we can get exceptions for the 17 Palestinians that are actually here as well.
Yep.
Was there anything else you want to add in?
Yeah, I would like to thank you. And I would like to just say something, if that's okay, about people originally from Gaza that are living here. I just would like to say that I feel people of Gaza, because of the difficult situation that we have lived for nearly all of our lives, that we are really hardworking people. If you meet us, we're like the people here that are living here in Ireland, around, let's say, 20, 25 families originally from Gaza living here in Ireland. I'll tell you, all of them are really hardworking people. They're either doctors, engineers, accountants. We all bought houses, all doing well in our careers. And I just hope that, just said, I would like to give that opportunity to my brother-in-law. He's a hardworking person. I know him. A lot of people say that they are from Gaza, are actually not. And I know that because I talk to someone and he says, oh, I am from Gaza, just pretending to be from Gaza. But when I listen to him, I know he's not from Gaza, you know. People of Gaza are really strong, hardworking people. Yeah, so really hope that things could be resolved for my parents, my parents-in-law, my brother-in-law, anyone who's really from Gaza. I just hope that he can have a good life, whether it's here in Ireland or anywhere, because they deserve life, you know.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
Ibrahim, thanks very much for coming in and sharing your story with us and enlightening us on the situation and the details that many people probably that aren't aware of, and for sharing your story of what it was like from October 7th to getting out of there. That's, we took a break earlier on, and I was saying to you, it was like describing the film, and people don't realise that you actually had to live through that. But again, thanks very much.
You're thanks welcome. Very much, Pat.
Take us out, Siobhan.
Boom.
Subscribe to this podcast for free on the Go Loud app.
What you waiting for? Put your back in it. Just a little more. Throw your whip in it now. Till your body attends. Walk it hard and slow. When you finish that.
The hypnotica.
Go down.
For almost 40 years, DR Power Equipment has been the go-to for homeowners who want professional-level outdoor power equipment. Whether you're managing acres of overgrown fields or just want to have the best lawn on the block, DR Power has everything you need to conquer your piece of the outdoors. Visit drpower.com today to learn more and shop the sale.